Tuning in. This has been an experiment with time on WRCT Pittsburgh. The show airs every Saturday night at midnight. Until next time, have a great night, folks, and take care of yourselves.
WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is the stormy weather.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Figure out what you can do and keep enlarging the circle of people that you draw to you who will take those steps. And be the one that says, hey, you know what? I'll be the one reading the news. I'll distill it down for everybody this week or this month, you know? And next week, it'll be your turn, right? So that we can all take care of each other, help protect each other's mental health. We'll commit to 5 actions a month that we all will take, and we'll hold each other accountable for that, and then we'll have a nice dinner. Whatever it is, figure out ways to build community around resistance.
That's Nadine Smith, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Nadine Smith on community and resistance in Florida. In a world increasingly shaped by far-right policies, corporate greed, and growing authoritarianism, it makes sense to feel afraid about what the future may hold. Building strong relationships with our friends, families, and neighbors provides a foundation for mutual aid and collective strength. It's through these connections that we can counter the isolating and exploitative systems imposed by predatory capitalism. When we build communities, we aren't just reacting to oppression, we are actively creating the world we wish to live in. Community building undermines the atomization demanded by autocratic regimes. It is both a shield against harm and the seed for a better tomorrow. Community is resistance. We see the forms it takes in Florida and elsewhere. Our guest today is Nadine Smith. She was a co-founder and executive director of Equality Florida. She's president and CEO of Color of Change, a national civil rights organization. She spoke in Orlando, Florida in late August. The moderator is Tom Scherberger. And now, Nadine Smith.
Everybody is aware that Florida is the laboratory for this fascist takeover. I mean, for years and years in politics in Florida, we've said, as goes Florida, so goes the nation. And I think it's because we are a microcosm. You know, we encompass in the geography of Florida both the North, the South, and Midwest politically. Project 2025 began long ago in our state, and we have seen the steady erosion, the one-party state government. We have seen the dismantling of public education, all of these things out of an authoritarian playbook. We in Florida, and to some degree Texas, have been on the front lines of how they have tested and refined those attacks on our democracy and on our freedoms. And so Frontline Florida was our way of saying to other people, don't just watch what's unfolding in Florida as though you're watching a spectacle. This is a canary in the coal mine moment. But not only are we the lab where these bad things are being created, we're also the lab where the resistance to it is also being forged. And so we've talked about Frontline Florida by way of telling people you don't abandon the front line in a fight. But Blueprint Florida is our way of saying, and the things we've learned here, we are exporting to other states that are politically in the same situation that we're in, but also to states that are better politically situated, so they can adapt the ways that we've learned to resist in Florida to circumstances where they can not only stop what the attack is, but actually build on it. So Frontline is to remind people that we are often the first ones to see what will be coming down the pike for the rest of the country. And Blueprint is to remember that it's at the point of friction that you find the vaccine. You know, if you saw the movie It or read the book, like every 50 years, this evil clown comes up from the sewer and just kind of feasts on all the negative feelings and foments them and then eventually recedes. And I feel like Florida has been in that grip. But it really, I mean, at the end of the day, what we are dealing with is the unresolved, unreconciled reality of the Confederacy. And, you know, we saw it after Reconstruction, this time of backlash and progress. And we should all be very, very clear that the attacks, for example, on the LGBTQ community, the attacks on immigrants, are rooted most firmly in anti-Blackness in America. And I will say it this way. When we talk about Anita Bryant, now, I was a kid when Anita Bryant went from trying to sell us orange juice to saying hateful, hateful things about gay people. Side note, I should thank her because of her, the PTL Club and the 700 Club, there's enough gray hair in the room that I know there are people that remember those shows. The first time I ever saw a Pride event was as B-roll on the 700 Club as they talked about homosexuals using very ominous tones. And I slowly realized that I was a homosexual. And I remember going to the library at Everett Junior High School and looking up homosexual. And there were two books in the library. One of them was called Front Runner, which was an award-winning book, but it was mostly for gay men. It was entirely for gay men. And then the other was supposed to be a nonfiction book. And I remember flipping through it, homosexual, comma, female. I'm going to paraphrase because this has been a while, but essentially it said, always angry, hates men, you know, wears plaid. And anyway, and I thought, kind of fond of my brothers, kind of fond of my dad. I did wear plaid, though. But then in the corner it said, see also bisexual, comma, female. And this was a new word, and so I looked that one up. And again, I'm paraphrasing, but it said something like, bisexuals are like Canadians, they walk among you, you'll never know. You know. So I spent a lot of time wondering if I was a sneaky bisexual. I'm trying to convey that there wasn't a whole lot of good information out there. But the PTL Club and the 700 Club, they were like, look at these women on motorcycles. And I thought, yes, look at those women on motorcycles. But I say that to say Anita Bryant, her first attack or her funding came from the moral majority. And this is long before they cared at all about abortion. In fact, I think they had positions that were fairly supportive of abortion. But the thing that animated them was a Supreme Court decision that would integrate schools. They didn't want their schools integrated. And they saw Anita Bryant as a useful tool for going up against public education with a message that was more palatable politically than a front door assault on integration, right? The same was true with the Johns Committee in the 50s and 60s. And this is when You know, I grew up on the Panhandle. Okay, help me remember. Is it the Pork Chop?
Pork Chop Gang, yep.
Up in North Florida, held all the power. And it was a plunder economy, much as it is today. As people began to move from the North to the South, they were bringing with them support for integration. And they began to gerrymander Florida in dramatic ways to suppress the political power of the southern part of the state. And again, they were driven by a fear that if that more and more people who were moving to Florida supported racial equity at some level. And there was an active NAACP that was making great strides. Their goal in all of this was to see the head of the NAACP in prison stripes on a photograph on the cover of the newspaper that would send the message, don't come down here with any of that nonsense. And the attack that the Johns Committee launched first and foremost was to destroy civil rights organizations and their leadership. The NAACP outsmarted them and in advance, anticipating the attack, moved all of their discoverable membership roles and everything to their Washington, D.C. headquarters. And Thurgood Marshall just kept outfoxing them all along the way. But because they had invested all of this money in building this infrastructure, they decided they would also go after political undesirables. And in that process, stumbled across a group of gay men in a theater group in Tallahassee, and then began to build out this massive infrastructure that gave themselves unprecedented power to destroy people's lives. So racism, coupled with the demonization of the LGBTQ community, is a go-to formula in the state of Florida, and it has been for decades upon decades upon decades.
You're talking about the rise of authoritarianism. You're talking about a fascist state. So let's talk about what has happened under Ron DeSantis. Just a few of the examples.
You see it daily in our schools. We see the censorship. We see them financially dismantling public education, refusing federal dollars to support education. We see a teacher shortage, and we see things like the Don't Say Gay, Don't Say Trans bill, the censorship of books on Rosa Parks, the censorship of any representation of LGBT people, the very existence of LGBTQ people. And so when you think about authoritarianism or fascism, they don't govern, they destroy. They will always test the boundaries of what we'll accept. First, they try it, and if it doesn't quite work, they call it a joke. Then they adapt it a little bit, try it again. And their attitude is, you can't defend everything. We'll flood the zone. This is their word. We'll flood the zone, and we'll wear you down. We'll put you into a position of frustration. Here's what they want. They want people to be incensed. They want people to respond in a manner that allows them to heighten and increase their authoritarian tactics. It's the same reason they have this massive show of force in DC, the same reason Trump has a massive show of force in Los Angeles. It's not to stop violence, is to provoke it. They are seeking to provoke the LGBTQ community to respond in a manner that allows them to be even more fascistic. I will share with you the wisdom of a drag queen. I was at an event, and this drag queen, she said, you know, we have to understand how tyranny works. And there's a very good book. I hope you will all read it. It's by a doctor named Seuss. And it's called The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. And she said, you know, the whole story is about the Grinch who cannot abide other people's happiness. And so he goes and he steals all of the symbols of their happiness, the decorations and the presents and the roast beast. And he hauls it all away up to his lonely mountain lair. And she said, this is the most important part. He takes out his binoculars because he wants to see the rage, the heartbreak. You know, he wants to see what devastation he's caused. And instead, what he sees are the people of Whoville singing as they always do, celebrating as they always do, because he does not understand that the symbols are not the people. And so I just think it's really important when shock and awe is their tactic, their strategy, for us to turn to each other and to build community in that moment and come together and make it really clear it's not going to work. So if you are on social media and your response to anything positive that anybody posts is, it's too late, it doesn't matter. If you have an Eeyore's disposition, you must know that you're doing the work of this administration. They want you to feel defeated at all turns. There's a quote that hope is a discipline, and it is. It's not phony optimism. Hope is seeing things very clearly and believing that when we look back over time, and certainly in my lineage, I can look back over time and see people in my family that have overcome more brutal circumstances with fewer resources. So the hope that I'm speaking of is not a soft and frilly thing. It is an indestructible thing. And it is the connection, the link in the chain that we have to remember of how people got through periods like the one we are experiencing now, where cruelty is the coin of the realm. Again, these things are not based on what is rational, and tyranny does not build, it does not govern, it simply destroys. Right now, I think what we're up against is people who have given up on the future and are simply thinking in terms of what they can grab. This is an administration that has gone after initiatives to preserve the environment, to stop greenhouse emissions. So if you had ESG or environmental components in your company's work plan, they're going after you. If you have DEI, I mean, in what world is it a Republican conservative, you know, value to tell businesses how they can and can't train their employees, how they can and can't direct their philanthropic giving? But they think nothing of intruding. They think nothing of government compelling, blackmailing, coercing, when it's in service to what they want. And right now, you know, they serve a constellation of billionaires, not the American people. They believe if they can seize all of the machinery of government, that we will simply comply. You know, it's not an accident that they seek to erase history. Again, we have to learn from these cycles. The Daughters of the Confederacy put up these monuments to Confederate soldiers, but 6 decades after the war. These were not statues that were part of that time period that are being preserved. These were part of a strategy for placing these monuments, often in front of courthouses, in significant places, as part of a rewriting of what the Civil War was. I grew up in the panhandle of Florida, and I was taught what the Daughters of the Confederacy wanted me to be taught, that this was a war of Northern aggression, that slavery played very little role in the Civil War, that the Confederate flag and Confederate monuments were simply long-existing symbols of a united America before the war on aggression, and that taking them down was an assault on our collective history. You know, of course, I learned later that none of that was true, that all of this was about rewriting history, and they rewrote history books, not to ignore slavery, but to glance over it. So after they changed military bases away from the names of traitors under previous administrations, they made a point of bringing them back and renaming them. And, you know, there are places where Confederate flags fly again. It is an attempt at death by a thousand cuts. So now the latest push is that the Smithsonian, in addressing slavery, is too negative, spends too much time talking about the bad things and not the bright and positive things, right? When I was in, I think it was seventh grade, my history teacher, who was also a football coach, who later went on to get shot in the buttocks by his ex-girlfriend, had suggested, these are not related, but he suggested that, you know, there's been enough, it had to be seventh grade because Roots came out when I was in sixth grade. It was a very interesting time to have Roots playing in the South and go to school, you know, the Monday after the Sunday installment. But he thought there was been enough negativity about slavery, and we should all write papers on the positive things that had come out of slavery. But yeah, so we are up against an attack not only on the infrastructure of democracy, but on our own sense of reality.
Pam Bondi fired Mike Gordon for doing his job, but Ron DeSantis previewed that by firing two state attorneys.
Yeah.
Who he claimed was not doing their job. So do you consider that also?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it even goes further than that, because there's the ones that he's fired, but the message he sent is, at the end of the day,
right. You
don't get to really vote for anybody, because I can remove anybody at will who I disagree with. You know, if I hold a gun to your head and make you sign a document, it's not legally binding. I have coerced you. I have threatened you. But we have a governor who routinely threatens people's livelihoods, their jobs, and their freedom. And so at what point do you acknowledge that you really don't have local electeds? You have people who are navigating his desires and their safety at all times.
Okay, this is all very depressing, Nadine. but so let's talk about the blueprint part of it. Where is it that you can point to some successes? I mean, I know Equality Florida was deeply involved in the bill that you cleverly rebranded "Don't Say Gay," and yeah. Is that part of the strategy? Was rebranding that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is about telling, you know, you can say controlling the narrative, but I would say telling the truth. They wanted to call it a thing about parents' rights when really it was a bill. The bill was about censoring. Yeah. It was about government intrusion. It was about people who didn't even have kids in the schools dictating what our kids could read, hear, whether people could put their spouse's picture on their desk. I mean, everything about it had nothing to do with protecting students, their parents, or teachers. And so we didn't let them get away with the phony baloney name they gave it. We told people what it actually did, what its intention was. And I think calling things what they are is a real part of pushing back.
You didn't stop there. I believe there was a lawsuit.
We took them to court. And here's the thing about the way fascism also works. They use intimidation. They want you to obey in advance based on your fear, not the actual letter of the law. So as they were passing this bill, this Don't Say Gay bill, they were saying the most outrageous things in chambers, but not putting the most outrageous language in the bill. But we would introduce amendments to surface the thing they really wanted to say, you know. So you had a lawmaker calling gay people demons. But we made them say out loud the thing that they wanted to imply, which was helpful in court because we were able to say, this is what they are trying to do. So if you think of a flashlight, right, and a mouse in front of a flashlight, the shadow that mouse throws is much bigger. Well, the mouse itself is the law, and its shadow is the spirit of the law. And they're hoping that the tainted, cruel spirit of the law is what schools would actually enforce. And by taking them to court, we were able to get a settlement that restricted them to the actual mouse itself. And what that meant was we were able to say to teachers, if you're asked to do something, make them put it in writing. make them reference the exact language that authorizes them to restrict this or stop you from doing that or what have you, and make them sign their name to it. And tell them you will follow any law, but you need it to be explicit. And what would happen is that memo would never come because the letter of the law would not support it. And so you have to have teachers and parents and administrators, with the fortitude to stand up and not capitulate in advance, even with things like these crosswalks where DeSantis, through the Florida Department of Transportation, is saying, oh, you got to get rid of them. You got to get rid of them because, they're dangerous, right? Because colorful, well-lit crosswalks, pose a problem, despite the fact that Florida DOT actually authorized and painted the crosswalk.
That liberal Rick Scott who approved that.
Yeah, right. And so we have at every turn forced them to say what they mean or abide by the letter of the law. When I talk about the blueprint, part of it is, number one, nothing goes unchallenged, whether it's at a school board meeting, city council, state agency, or in the legislature. We show up and we push back. There's this thing, if you've read Timothy Snyder's On Tyranny or followed any of the people who have organized in Putin's Russia or, in any of these emerging and totalitarian area regions of the country, of the world, they will tell you that you push back. You support institutions not because they're perfect or not even because they're not failing, but because you need to demonstrate that they ought to work, right? So you vote even in places where the system isn't working properly to stand on the value that it ought to matter that you vote, right? And you can have a critique of public schools, for example, but you support the schools in your community, you support public schools because we ought to have a system of public schools that functions for everyone regardless of your income. And so I say that to say part of pushing back is showing up in a legislature, even when it was completely lopsided, single party, with both chambers fearful of the retributive cruelty of Ron DeSantis. We still talked to them as though we expected them to be independent branches, and eventually they became more independent. We were able to defeat 21 out of 22 anti-LGBT bills in 1 year, and then the next year we killed all of them. Well, I will say this, I feel as though our messaging was a huge part, not alone, but a huge part of ending Ron DeSantis's presidential ambitions. And I say that because sometimes people forget that all of these, oligarchs, all of these South African billionaires, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, David Sachs, all of them were lined up behind Ron DeSantis. They saw him as a more disciplined, smarter, more charismatic. I know it's hard for me to get these words out, but there was a glimmering moment. He made his big announcement on Twitter, Twitter live moderated by Elon Musk. And so, while he wanted to talk about Florida as this pathway to, he was calling it Freedom Florida, we were, showing images of empty bookshelves and talking about censorship and having the voices of parents whose schools were being torn apart by his policies. And so censorship and government intrusion and surveillance were the ways that people thought of Ron DeSantis outside of Florida. We put together an ad as the bill was making its way through the legislature that had, it took place in the classroom, and you see a little girl in her chair and she looks over at her best friend and her best friend gives her a little nod of courage and she walks to the front of the class, and on the whiteboard behind her, it says, Heroes, and that's the topic. And this nervous little girl begins by saying, I want to talk about my heroes, my two moms. And a light flashes in the back, a red light flashes, and the teacher looks down at the Don't Say Gay bill on her desk, and she takes a deep breath and she says, go ahead, you should be proud. And then over the loudspeaker comes a voice that says, Mrs. Evans, report to the front office. That was the entirety of the commercial. We had no money whatsoever to make the commercial. We relied on the kindness of strangers to get the commercial made. We had no money to air it, but we began running it online and got enough money to air it in Tallahassee during session. By the time the bill moved its way through the legislature, it had earned over $3 billion in earned media. And one of our staff members who was traveling overseas said, anytime people knew I was from Florida, the first thing they would say to me is, ah, don't say gay. We completely defined what that bill did so that people could understand what he was pushing.
You're listening to Nadine Smith on Community and Resistance in Florida. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Let's talk about the trans issue, because mm-hmm. that became the wedge. Immigration, obviously, mm-hmm. was the big wedge issue in this last presidential election.
But yeah.
Trans athletes.
Yep.
Also going back to, you know, what's strange is how much progress had been made in the last 10 years. You know, it was only 8 years ago, North Carolina, there was a furor over their bathroom bill. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
They repealed it. But now here we are. We're back. They have bathroom bills. We have a college student at FSU from Tallahassee who was arrested for using the wrong
right.
restroom. Trans rights were really making a progress. Did that move too fast, do you think? Or was it just the low-hanging fruit that the opposition could use?
Here's the thing to remember. The first big wedge issue for the right was gay people serving in the military. I shouldn't say it's the first big wedge issue, but gay people serving in the military is a huge wedge issue. When I was at the Air Force Academy in 83, 84, this was before Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And cadets were being kicked out of the military, some in their final year, being charged for their entire education and getting dishonorable discharges and feeling lucky that they weren't arrested. So the scapegoating has a long history. And then it was marriage. Gay marriage was the wedge issue. And now what has happened, there's a right-wing think tank called the American Principles Project. They're quoted in a New York Times article where they said the legalization of marriage and the broad public support for it made it no longer an effective tool as a wedge issue. And so they said we had to find something else. They said we threw all of these issues up against the wall, and to our surprise, what stuck was trans issues. And they said the American people did not know enough about this issue, did not know enough people who were trans, and we knew we could work with that. What they meant was we could take in ignorance, and instead of turning it to curiosity and education, we could turn it to fear. And with that fear, we could do what we had done with marriage. And that's what they've done. They spent hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars demonizing, vilifying trans people. And it has had an impact. But I think we're starting to see the blowback. Like, they targeted Black voters in the South with some very specific campaigns. And we did some polling, and what it showed was, even among people who did not know much about transgender issues, was a suspicion that they'd seen this kind of thing before, and they didn't like it. It's kind of like with marriage, they went to the well too often. I guarantee anytime Ron DeSantis starts talking about transgender people, scan the headlines, because somewhere there's going to be the Hope Foundation or a lawsuit that he's lost or some bad news that he's trying to steer everybody away from. It's like a tell in poker. Just push all your chips in because he's trying to distract you.
And now they're going after drag shows and brunches.
Well, that's the other thing. You know, we did this. I put out on Facebook, I said, are there any cisgender women who are willing to dress in high drag and risk arrest to test this law? Because it was sort of, we were inside, we were calling it Operation Dolly Parton because it was sort of like, why isn't she arrested the moment she crosses into Florida? Like, what makes something drag? And are the police going to be at malls, you know, stopping women who are wearing slacks?
Well, are they going to be in bathrooms checking to see if someone has the right genitals to use?
It's already started. It's already started. There are at least five instances in the last month and a half or so of mostly teenage girls, cisgender teenage girls, being pursued into the bathroom, harassed. Sometime in the last week, there was a girl who said the server made her basically pull up her shirt and demonstrate that she had breasts. So, you know, all of these laws intended to attack trans women are at their core anti-women. They want to define women in a manner that is as narrow as possible. And, you know, it is not an accident. The sports issue is fascinating to me because I want to say that in any legislature, if you cannot name five women athletes, you cannot vote on a bill that has anything to do with women's sports.
You run an organization, and you have a lot of supporters, but what should the average person do? I mean, is rage posting on Facebook effective? Or going to a protest?
Yeah.
What can the average person do?
You know, when I was in college, I visited Greenham Common, which is a women's encampment in England, where women, left their homes to join this encampment to protest nuclear weapons. And there was a general who spoke, and there's a big song about Greenham Common where they sing about the fact that, you know, when men go off to war, we accept that they must leave their families, they must leave those comforts and go do something important. But when women leave their homes to protest things that threaten life on the planet, they're talked about as though they've abandoned their true post. But he said, you know, not everyone can do what these women have done. This is an incredible sacrifice. And he said, so maybe that's not for you. And there's some people that can protest and risk arrest. And maybe that's not for you. And there are some people who will go to a city council meeting or a legislative meeting. And maybe you can't do that. Maybe what you can do is write letters. Maybe that's the place that you feel like I can do that. He said, but if that's the place that you say that's what I can do, then do it every single day. And so the range of ways that people can have influence, you got to look at your own life. You may be friends with, high school friends with, have relationships with some of these people. You know, when I talked about Pam Bondi being a shapeshifter and cutting her conscience to fit her ambition, I spoke to her quite a bit. You know, we talked about, you know, trans people that were in her life that she wanted to be supportive of, and
she has a lot of gay friends. She told us
she has a lot of gay friends. No, she's got a lot of.
And I actually, since I've known her for years, I think that's actually true.
There was a story about her. I don't remember how many years ago, but in it they did a public records request of all of her documents and who she texted, and in the article it said, she also spent a great deal of time texting Nadine Smith, the head of Equality Florida, and her texts would include rainbow emojis and hearts. But I find it in some ways more abhorrent when somebody who knows better submerges their actual values in service of a dictator. If somebody arrives in a place that I disagree with out of a honest evaluation, then I feel like I can at least speak to those values and have some possibility of them seeing the world differently. But when you go, you will go whichever way the wind blows, I don't know what language to speak to you.
The average Trump supporter, you have to find a way to talk to folks. You have to find a way to talk to each other. In fact, you had a podcast interview not too long ago with one of the leaders of the marriage equality movement, and he talked about how the language is very important if you want to try to get people to come over to your side. You know, calling somebody a moron, you're all morons and Nazis, that doesn't seem like a very effective approach to winning people over to your side.
I agree. The expression I use is you got to leave the light on for people. You know, the world of Trump and MAGA, it's not a single thing. It's overlapping Venn diagrams of different constituencies, some of them drawn for completely different reasons. I interviewed a guy named Rich Loges, who's the founder of Leaving MAGA. And he and I met when I spoke at Howard University. I was speaking to students about journalism, and he was one of the few white people in the audience, and he was right up front. And he's a tall guy, and when it came, and I had said something about leaving the light on. And so when the Q&A came, he raised his hand, and he was maybe the first or second person called on. And, you know, he said, "I'm Rich Loges, I'm from Delray Beach, and I'm MAGA." And I thought, oh God, it's about to happen. But he said, "At least I was until about 6 months ago." And he said, "I appreciate you saying leave the light on." And we ended up having a 45-minute conversation in a stairwell. And it was really helpful to me because he had been, I believe, a Nader, Obama, Trump voter. And you go, how does somebody make that devolution? But for him, what he was drawn to is disruptors of what he saw as a broken system, which is, I think, relatable. And so to me, you know, one of the rules around dealing with authoritarians is use mockery on them, but not on their followers. When religious groups knock on your door and, you know, they're there to convert you to whatever they believe, the function of that is not actually to convert you, but to isolate them, to give them a sense of being rejected by the main and more dependent upon the infrastructure of their faith. And, cults function that way too. And so in the same way, when Hillary Clinton said, "Many are good people, but there is a basket of deplorables," they clung to deplorables. I mean, that became for them, this is the evidence that we are this outside band, demonized, vilified, this victim mentality that runs so deep, this grievance mentality that sees anything that shifts us closer to equality as deprivation for them is part of the mindset. And so, yes, be, you know, the leadership that wants to project an air of invincibility and strength, you rupture that every time you can. It's Charlie Chaplin making fun of Hitler. It is Gavin Newsom thoroughly roasting Trump, right?
Maybe it's South Park, too.
It's South Park, right? Yeah, leave the light on and be curious. Be the exact opposite of how they approach the world. In times of turbulence and uncertainty, people are drawn to those who will tell them, this is the way. You no longer have to live in the torment of grayness and indecision. So, psychologically, there's some satisfaction in it. But I think one of the strategies that I find to be helpful, and it's actually more my personality, is to say, where did you hear that? Why did you think that? Oh, send that article to me. My friend Rich, who I mentioned earlier, you know, he talked about how he came to walk himself back out of MAGA. It wasn't like a bolt of sudden revelation. He said, the first contradiction I dismissed as unimportant. The second one, I said, okay, I can't reconcile this, but I'm on a bigger mission. And he said, and the third one, I couldn't get past. But he also told me that he saw lots of people quietly quitting, but they found themselves in a place where they had burned all their bridges to their Democratic family members, more progressive people in their lives. And their whole worlds had begun to revolve around this identity within this MAGA world. And to leave meant to occupy a no man's land. Like he told me, if I'd met you while I was still MAGA, I would literally consider you an enemy combatant. And he said, and if we agreed on 99.9% of things, I would consider you an enemy combatant, because if you are not 100% with us, you are a liability. And so, yeah, that little bit of daylight, a little bit of curiosity. A friend of mine who was a police officer, we got into a big fight about Ferguson. And she was telling me that the things you're posting aren't true, and I've got the inside skinny, and we had a real big fight. I said, okay, here's what has to happen. We have to have some rules for engagement. We'll speak about this for 1 hour. You know, I will read anything you send me. You read anything I send you. And it made me more responsible in how I talked about all of it. I read the FBI reports. I read all of those things. But she also read what I sent her. And at the end of it, she ended up joining a group of police officers looking to reform. And it became sort of like we could have just stayed in that place of clashing. But I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about this either, because it is very hard to reach people who have forged their entire identity around belonging. They're like, it's not that they are too, that people are too stupid. It is not that. It is this. It is a sense of purpose. It is a sense of community. It is a feeling of belonging. It is a sense that they've been called to a bigger purpose. Dr. King called it the drum major instinct, that we all want to have that sense about ourselves. And so that's why I say treating people simply with contempt rather than curiosity pushes them deeper in and further away from those friction points where a little bit of light might get in, where the aperture through which they get their information might expand. And it is also true that we need not put ourselves in situations where we are experiencing relentless abuse. So I have no problem with people who have cut folks out of their lives. From a political standpoint, I would say you may be the only person who can remind people of who they were before they went into this closed, narrow worldview that has cut them off from everything but service to this man.
People have questions? But I have one last question, because mm-hmm. you've been doing this for a long time, and a lot of folks here are already worn out. So how do you keep going, and what advice do you have for them?
When I think of our blueprint, number one, it was meet them wherever they bring this fight. And we work to defeat what we can defeat, defang what we can't, and set up for legal challenge those things that get through. But another big part of it is build unprecedented coalitions. Understand that even if it's your community under attack, it is simply part of a broader attack on democracy itself that will always target Black people, Indigenous people of color. The attack is multifaceted, and the response must be multicultural and involve people that maybe you've never organized with before. So we've built new coalitions, and we're working with people that not too long ago never would have been on our radar screen. The other part of it is an understanding that they project more power than they have, and that we have to defy them at every turn, and we can have fun with that. There are times that require a solemn recognition of the harm that they are doing. You know, putting a concentration camp in the Everglades and gleefully talking about people being killed and devoured by alligators requires a solemnity. But there are other things that require Bugs Bunny energy, you know? playful mischief and a sense of defiance that is inspiring. And we will engage in that too. But I want everyone to have in your mind two images. One is of sand in the gears. Now, sand thrown into the gears sometimes slow down the machinery. And when you're talking about legislative sessions, slowing down the machinery may be all you need to kill a bill. But sand in the gears can also bring a machine to a shuddering halt. And you do not know which grain of sand it is that finally stops the machine. So that's why it may be you showing up at a rally, it may be your phone call, it may be your letter, it may be your contribution. So never think that what you are doing is not sufficient to the task. Understand that you are a grain of sand and we are creating an avalanche of sand into that machine. And then the second image that I want to leave you with is this one. I mentioned Dr. Seuss earlier, but this one is from a professor at Boston University named Stephen Prothero. And he talks about this attack that we are experiencing is a lagging indicator that, you know, when they go after all of this cultural change, by the time this backlash arrives, it is basically a signal that the culture already has shifted and that what they are doing is attempting to claw back, but we're past the tipping point. So they'll do a lot of damage, they'll do a lot of harm, but the backlash to the backlash is real and it's coming. So in addition to a handful of sand, keep in your mind a slingshot. So they think they are dragging us backwards, but what they are doing is creating the tension that when we break their grip, we don't just come back to where we started, where their attack began. It is the fuel to propel us into a future and make things possible, just like it did in marriage equality, just like it has done on civil rights, to spring forward. And so we simultaneously must push back against this authoritarianism, but where the hope shows up is visualizing the future we actually want, with institutions as they ought to be, with the communities the way they deserve to be, with a world that our kids and our grandkids deserve to be born into. And that hope and that vision will hold you through the harder times. And we don't want to fumble that moment where we do break their grip, because that is where massive transformation happens very quickly, whether it's the oligarchs of the golden era paving the way for the New Deal. And we have to be ready for that now.
Okay, great. I've got some questions.
You know, I'm a news junkie, and I'm with it all the time. And one of the things that I'm on right now is what is happening in D.C., the militarization and the takeover of law enforcement in D.C. I try to talk to people about this, like, how can we be tolerating this? What are we doing about it? And so many people tell me, I can't talk about it. I'm protecting my mental health. I can't be involved. I've turned off the news. I've shut off my social media. I'm out. What do we do about that?
The privilege to do that is real. And I understand it. I mean, I do think that it is important for people not to chug poison. And I also know that the goal of the stated goal, as I said earlier, is to flood the zone. So people are responding precisely as they were anticipated to respond. So I would say if I encounter somebody, I go, great, rest up, because we're going to need you. And know that there are a lot of other people who are ready to fill in that space. And I think it is okay. It's like, I believe that we should be engaging people in our community who voted for Trump. But I also make a distinction between that and consistently putting yourself in the presence of somebody who depletes, you know, just strip mines the minerals out of your body with their nonsense. Yeah, it can be frustrating, but I would say if anyone ever says to me, I'm taking a mental health break, fantastic. We'll come back because we're going to need you. I think we have to do two things. One, ridicule the leadership and have some grace, empathy, and curiosity for their followers. And then the other thing that I think is also true is we have to assess what levers of power we have. Economic power we have. Don't spend your money in places that don't hold the values to the best of your ability, right? And for small businesses, if you walk into a business, ask them, do you have a non-discrimination policy? Where do you stand? And it is about, I don't want to spend my money any more than I want to spend my vote on people that don't respect my basic dignity. And have conversations. Invite people over and say, hey, you know, I just want to say that I'm watching what's happening in D.C. and it's really scary and I find myself not even wanting to watch the news. But I think there's some things that maybe we can do. And maybe it's meet with the local police department and say, I'm watching what's happening in D.C. What will you do if those orders come for Florida? Just like that general said, you might not join an encampment. You might not lay your body in front of police tanks. But figure out what you can do and keep enlarging the circle of people that you draw to you who will take those steps. And be the one that says, hey, you know what? I'll be the one reading the news. I'll distill it down for everybody this week or this month, you know, and next week it'll be your turn, right? So that we can all take care of each other, help protect each other's mental health. We'll commit to 5 actions a month that we all will take, and we'll hold each other accountable for that, and then we'll have a nice dinner. Whatever it is, figure out ways to build community around resistance.
You were just listening to Nadine Smith on community and resistance in Florida. She spoke in Orlando in late August. Nadine Smith was a co-founder and executive director of Equality Florida. She's president and CEO of Color of Change, a national civil rights organization. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Arundhati Roy, Chris Hedges, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Nadine Smith on Community and Resistance in Florida, and for the classic Noam Chomsky book, The Myth of American Idealism, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Special thanks to WMNF in Florida. Special thanks to WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
If we choose life, if we choose love, community, and reverence, we will not only avoid self-destruction, we will usher in a future of immeasurable promise. That is a future worth working for with all our heart and soul. We will prosper together in our care for life, or we will perish together in our exploitation of life to make money for the already morbidly rich. The choice is ours.
That's David Corton, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features David Corton on the future of humanity. We are at a dangerous moment in human history. Philosopher and thinker David Corton says, we stand at a crossroads between two possible futures. In one future, we continue on the path of separation and likely bring the human chapter of creation's journey to an untimely end. In the other future, Corton says, we find our rightful place as responsible, loving members of the Earth community in an ecological civilization, helping to guide creation's journey into a future of harmony and new possibilities. The choice could not be more profound. It is, in a real sense, a test of what being human truly is. Our guest today is the visionary intellectual David Corton. For several decades, he was an insider in the development establishment. He worked for the Ford Foundation and USAID and taught at Harvard's Graduate School of Business. Having severed his ties to the past, today he is a leading voice for economic and social justice. He's the author of many books, including When Corporations Rule the World and Agenda for a New Economy. He spoke in late August in Bainbridge Island, Washington. And now, David Corton.
We live in a time of profound challenge and opportunity. The signs of crisis are all around us. A mounting perfect storm of climate disruption, ecological...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.